Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
So welcome everybody to this public lecture organised by the Maths Department here at LSE. So I'm Professor Andrew Lewis, a member of the Maths Department here. Our speaker tonight is Professor Ehud Shapiro. So he's a Professor Emeritus at the Weizmann Institute of Science. He's also a visiting professor in the Maths Department and the Data Science Institute here. So Ehud's made foundational contributions in a wide variety of different fields. I believe it's part of his motivation for coming to LSE. A lot of his early work was inspired by Karl Popper, who of course founded the Department of Philosophy, Logic and Scientific Method here. So some of Ehud's early work was concerned with developing algorithmic interpretations of Popper's methodology. He's also done foundational work in the automation of program debugging. He developed the programming language Concurrent Prologue. Decades ago, he was well ahead of his time in developing early versions of the metaverse for social networking. He's also worked extensively in biology, on molecular computation, and the human cell lineage tree. So Ehud was also an early internet entrepreneur. For a long time, he's been a proponent of global digital democracy. And most recently, his work focused on how to support digital democracy by devising an alternative grassroots architecture for interactions in the digital realm. So that's what he's going to talk to us about today. So now the idea is Ehud will talk for about 45 minutes or so. There'll be lots of time for questions at the end. But now I'll hand over to Ehud.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. I prepared the popular talk, but I see such a dense intellectual crowd here. Maybe I should up the ante. In the questions and answers, you can ask questions and answer period. You can ask as any complicated questions you want. So I was there when the web started, and initially it had only documents and links. So people uploaded documents and had links from one document to the other. And I had this idea, why don't we add people to the web? And I founded in 1993 a company called Ubique, and our mission was adding people to the web. So this was quite early on. It was more than a decade before Facebook, more than a decade before the first iPhone. And I was really a bit at a loss as to how to start a company that does internet software. So I was looking around for precedents. Maybe I can find any other internet companies. There was one. It had a Gopher server that was selling subscriptions to weekly magazines, Newsweek and The Economist. That was the only business on the internet when I was looking for examples to follow. I also wanted to sell software on the internet. And I was looking for a lawyer that understands intellectual property on the internet, and there was no web search engines. So we had mailing lists. So I sent over several mailing lists a question: does anybody know a lawyer who understands something about intellectual property over the internet? And you know how many answers I got? Zero. But the funniest thing was when I wrote the business plan for an internet software company, and I submitted it to several venture capitalists. What do they think? They were thrilled about it, they liked it, they wanted to fund it, they didn't want to fund it. What did they say? Well, they said, I have a typo. I don't know how to spell internet, that you spell internet with a hyphen. So literally, I founded an internet software company at a time where VCs did not know how to spell internet, literally. Okay, that was that early. Still, I was able to raise money, and we had excellent technology at our disposal, which was developed earlier by my team at the Weizmann Institute of Science. And in 1995, the same day that Netscape launched its browser and server, we launched Virtual Places. It was the first internet social networking software. We had online, if it looks like Windows 95 applications, it was because it was a Windows 95 application. We had online events, we had chat rooms, we had instant messages, we had voice over IP, we had guided tours of the web, for those who don't know how to go to the web. It was all there. But it was, as I said, it was too early, so the VCs who didn't know how to spell internet didn't believe you can make money on the internet, so I had to sell the company. I sold it to America Online. They didn't know what to do with it after they bought it, so I bought it back, and then I sold it to IBM, which they finally figured out what to do with it. They were quite successful with our technology. And I said, okay, enough buying and selling and this, I should do something else. And at the same time, more or less, there was the Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace. Who heard of it? Okay, it was a momentous event in the early days of the internet. In Davos, 1996, John Perry Barlow gave a profound declaration, and the final sentence was, we will create a civilization of the mind in cyberspace. May it be more humane and fair than the world your governments have made before. That was 96. So I decided, I thought the internet is in good hands, things are developing well, I can go and do other things. And for a couple of decades, I went back to do basic science. I did work on molecular computers, as Andy mentioned, and work on the human selenage tree. And 2 decades after the Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace, I was invited to the World Economic Forum in Davos, same place, in 2016, to talk about my basic science research. And, you know, I didn't feel like being the entertainment for the rich and famous. I thought I should give them a piece of my mind after 2 decades of what's going on in the internet. So I said, I wanted to talk about internet democracy, I told the organizers. So, hell broke loose. We're gonna have 40 heads of states which are not democratic. How can you talk about democracy, you know? So I said, no, it's not about democracy, it's about internet democracy. It's completely unrelated, don't worry. So they agreed, and I gave, part of my talk was about my basic science, and part was about internet democracy, and what I said is that 20 years later, after the declaration of cyberspace, it's not what we hoped. We thought the internet will be the great equalizer. It will bring participation everywhere, democracy everywhere, knowledge everywhere. And instead, it became something very different. And I said that we are now in the internet middle ages. It's divided into fiefdoms with lords that set for us rules of conduct, interpretation, implementation, all branches of government controlled by individuals no matter wherever we go. You know what happened after the Middle Ages, right? We had the Age of Enlightenment. So I said, it's time for the Age of Enlightenment. And this event changed the course of my scientific endeavor, and I said, okay, I shouldn't just say it's time, but I should try to help bring this Age of Enlightenment, and that was what I've been working for the last decade, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. So that was 2016, 10 years ago. A decade has passed. What can I show for my efforts? Well, if we look at the state of things now, I think the internet turned from bad to worse. And this is an example from The Economist a year or two ago. Basically, it says that our options are either to be in the pocket of Elon Musk or in the pocket of Zuckerberg. That's the two options we have on the internet. And millions of migrants from around the world are taking the daunting leap from one pocket to the other, switching from X to Threads or whatever. More generally, the internet is dominated by centralized platforms with autocratic control. One server or cloud entity controlled by one person or one entity. Facebook, Amazon, Uber, and we're all visitors there without any civil rights or vote, or we have no say how to run Facebook, or how to run Amazon, or how to run Uber, even though we live there and use it every day. Up and coming, decentralized infrastructure, which is actually a major architectural revolution from computer science perspective, Bitcoin, Ethereum, blockchain technology, promised decentralization, distribution of power, changed the world. And indeed, as we know, this is a very important and worthy and wealthy technology. But fundamentally, structurally, it's plutocratic in the sense that power is divided according to the amount of money, one coin, one vote. It's not a decision by any people, good or bad. It's fundamentally what these platforms have are not verifiable identities. They have verifiable resources. So all you can do is use your resources to influence things, whether it's computing power or ether or whatever. And that's how control is divided. So that's the world today. And in terms of control of wealth or ownership of wealth or control, it's perhaps one of the most unequal, centralized, concentrated things or economies or sources of wealth in human history, where a tiny, 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 tiny fraction of humanity has majority of wealth and majority and control of these technologies. So we thought the internet will be the great equalizer. It's the great disequalizer until now. Just on a side note, sustainability. Bitcoin is a total environmental disaster, consumes electricity somewhere between Argentina and Pakistan. And that's, again, structurally, fundamentally, the way it's being built. And AI is trailing behind and probably will overtake Bitcoin in terms of energy use. And I'll tell you a secret, it's not for the benefit of humanity that they're doing it. They're doing it for the benefit, other benefits, but not for the benefit of humanity. Another thing we had in the early days of the internet, we had this idea of a sharing economy. We can use the internet to transfer information about who needs to be where and who wants to go where. And if we only share our beds with fellow travelers and our cars with fellow passengers, the world will become a better place. That was kind of the mantra of the early sharing economy. What happened is, again, that platforms became the totally centralized in terms of control, and we have millions of workers who are being exploited without even basic worker rights, and probably we should call it feudal economy rather than the sharing economy. And workers lack sick leave, holidays, pensions, job security. But for me, the most disturbing aspect is that they've significantly elevated rates of depression and anxiety. Okay, so we wanted to create a better world, and we created something that causes people to be depressed and anxious. So how can we fix all that? Okay, don't be so gloomy, you know. Maybe there's hope. So when a scientist faces a huge, complex, difficult challenge, what do they do? You know? Well, they consult authority. That's what they do. Fortunately, we have here at LSE a formal moral and scientific authority, our president, Barry Kramer. And if you haven't listened to his inaugural lecture, you should. He presented five challenges for the social sciences. And they converted later to Shaping the World campaign for LSE. And here they are. We want democracy, which engages everyone in shaping it. We want an economy that works better for everyone. We want sustainable future for the world. We want to eliminate inequalities, to have shape a world of systemic inclusion. All truly noble goals. And LSE is raising money to realize them. Now, if we convert this, you know, slide or thought to the digital world, it suddenly sounds totally absurd, you know, totally disconnected from reality. What about digital democracy and the internet? Digital economy works for everybody. Sustainability, digital equality. The current digital platforms are anathema to democracy, to economy that works for all, to equality, and to sustainability. That's the current state of the digital realm. And the goal of my research started about a decade ago, but I was not, only now I can express it so eloquently using the example and vision of LSE, to have digital platforms that do support democracy, economy that works for all, equality, sustainability, to replace autocratic and plutocratic platforms. So that's what we've been doing, my colleagues, including Andy, did you know you were doing this?
Yeah.
Andy and students and postdocs, and now Francesco, who is here, that's what we're trying to do. So what can I show for these 10 years of work? Well, it's about a pile, this thick, of papers, mathematical papers. To the naked eye, they all look the same. Definition, theorem, proof, definition, theorem, proof, definition, theorem, proof. That's what we've done. They're all available on the archive. If you search for it under my name, you'll see these papers. And what they do, they aim to offer a foundation for a new type of digital platforms, which we call grassroots platforms. That's what this pile of mathematical papers do. They try to build a foundation. And one way to view these future platforms as egalitarian platforms, that if you see on the left, there's one cloud, one server in the cloud. On the middle, there are multiple servers, each controlled by a different entity. On the right, in grassroots platforms, there is nothing in the cloud, just people, smartphones connected to each other. That's how it should work, democratically and in an egalitarian way. One way to summarize them, actually this summary was produced by AI, it's actually pretty good. Grassroots platforms are controlled and operated by the people they serve. Multiple independent instances that may coalesce, so you can start a platform here and here and here independently, you don't need anybody's permission, and they can emerge. Egalitarian by design, no third party control, manipulation, or rent extraction, and operate on network smartphone, as I said, serverless, permissionless. So that's a very kind of high level description of what grassroots platforms are. So we contend that grassroots platforms will support democracy, economy that works for all, equality and sustainability, with the goal of replacing autocratic and plutocratic platforms. So if they're so good and so promising and so exciting, why have we done just math for the last 10 years? Why haven't we done anything useful? And there are two answers, actually. One is that indeed the challenge was difficult, and we needed these 10 years. And actually, some of the missing pieces of the puzzle were finished on the last couple of months. One fundamental paper with Indian colleagues and some others. So in retrospect, even though we were, especially my students, they said, okay, when are we going to write some software, you know? I was always saying 6 months, you know? For the last 10 years, I said 6 months, we'll start doing software. So even though they wanted, we didn't do it. And in retrospect, had we stopped any time earlier, it would have been too early and we have been using a not sufficiently robust and correct foundation. So I think finally we have it. The other reason is, you know, I started an internet software company once. I know how to raise money, how to write a business plan. I still have some contacts, even though they all have white hair or no hair by now. So theoretically, I could just do it, except that this is a totally different beast. This is a not-for-profit technology that has to be a public good in a fundamental way. So for one reason, we were sort of doing this math and not jumping into the water and swimming, is that I didn't know how to do that. I didn't figure out what entity, what institute, how to raise money to hire, you know, top-notch programmers to build top-notch technology that is not for profit. So now I have an answer. I don't need it. We have AI. And for the last 6 months, actually I jumped into the water and started swimming together with AI, and it's a great experience. I can tell you more in the QA if you ask, but basically I think today that with a mathematical foundation and AI, we can realize these platforms with almost virtually zero funding and very few people. Okay, that's sort of my current belief. I think AI is powerful enough to build grassroots platforms with competitive apps, especially given the mathematics. And actually all my experience in the last 6 months is giving AI mathematical papers and instructing it to write software based on the math. So that's basically the strategy I've been following. And I think smartphones are powerful enough to carry that. They've been for several years now, but again, going back to the early internet days, when we built our social network, we used the most powerful Unix servers that we could buy. These were Sun Microsystem workstations, initially Sun 1, Sun 2, Sun 3, Sun Ultra, you know, the most powerful Sun Unix workstations we could buy. Today, my smartphone, is it here? No, it's over there. My smartphone is probably 1,000, 10,000, maybe more times more powerful, has more memory, has faster internet compared to the workstations that we're using then. So the smartphones today are powerful enough to do that. The reason we're not using them for these purposes, the main reason is that it's not in anybody's commercial interest, okay? Except maybe Apple and Samsung. We can talk about it later. So they're smart, they're powerful enough to do it already. So we can do it. So why don't we do it? Let's do it. So I'm going to show you two examples. One is Child Safe Social Networking, and the other is Grassroots Federation of Sharing Economy, co-ops. Child Safe Social Networks, I think it's a dear topic to everybody, whether it's children or grandchildren or expects to have children. And I'm talking about children, not adolescents or young adults. I'm talking about children who are totally under the responsibility of their parents and get a smartphone at the age of 6, 7, 8, 9, something like that. And how do we make it safe for them? And actually, that's another slide. Usually I have AI under a tight leash, you know, but this slide Claude actually produced totally on its own. So it's a very good slide. It says there are two crises, one cause. Children are exploited for engagement, workers are exploited for commission. In the same architecture, same structural cause, the platform operator has complete control and the business model conflicts with the welfare of the people the platform serves. Okay, good, it's a good slide. So the architecture is the problem. Okay, and we offer an alternative architecture, which we hope will be the solution. So child safety, I don't need to say much about this. Maybe only the last sentence, that only an architecture that does not grant control to its operator can put parents in control. Because child safety is the responsibility of parents, first and foremost. And on the internet today, they cannot exercise their responsibility. They just let their children take a dive and there's nothing they can do about it. So, grassroots child safe social network, how would it look? It's not a product, we're still in early stages, but it's a concept and a prototype, you'll see. It has one principle. Child safety is responsibility of the parent. And again, existing social networks cannot do it because to do this, they have to release control to the parent, but they want to be in control. So two children can become friends if and only if both children desire the friendship, both parents consent, and the parents are already friends, okay? So it's a transaction that involves four people, two parents, two children. And what we see here is actually a trace of the software running, actually written by Claude under my guidance. And what we see here, think about it, is it's not running on smartphones, it's not a simulation, it's a test environment. So think about each square as one phone. So we have three parent phones and three child phones. And what we see here is the trace of the session. And what the session has, it has three parents, Alice, Bob, and Charlie, that become friends with each other. So friendship is a binary transaction. Alice and Bob agree to become friends, and then Alice and Charlie agree to become friends, and then Bob and Charlie agree to become friends. So three things, three binary transactions. And then they allow their children to become friends. And these are three quaternary transactions. In each of these transactions, the two parents and the two children have to consent and volition this transaction to happen. And then Carol, which is one of the children, creates a group, and it can invite to the group only children who are already her friends. So, but Dave and Eve are already her friends, so she invites them, and then the three kids chat. So all this you see in this trace, it's working code running. It's working code that would run on smartphones once we deploy this successfully on smartphones. Okay, so that's one example. Another example, just so you see the spirit of, and that's it. There's nothing else. All you need is six smartphones connected to the internet. There's no third party, no Zuckerberg, no Musk, nobody. Three phones running the software can establish that on their own. That's it. Okay? Six phones, sorry. As another example, adult managed group. So we would like the teacher to have a group with our children, or the coach of the athletic team or whatever, instructor to have a group with our children. So how can this happen? First, the coach has to be our friend. So because in grassroots social networking, there's no global director or anything, just people talk to their friends, that's all. Okay, so it has to be our coach has to be our friend so they can talk to us, to the parents. And then for a child to become a member of the group that the teacher created, the teacher, the parent, and the child have to consent. Okay, and that's what we see here. The teacher, Alice, befriends the parents, Bob and Charlie. Alice creates a study group. Alice invites Dave and Eve, join the group, and Bob and Charlie and the children consent. And then the teacher and the two children can chat. Okay, so that's an example. Okay, how are we doing on time? Oh, we're doing reasonably well.
Fine.
Okay, so that's, since we're doing so well, on time, if you have a question, you can interrupt me. Because I thought we have to run quickly, but okay, we can ask.
In the previous slide, we have three parents.
Yeah, so here we have three parents and three children.
So a child has only one parent.
The child needs the consent of one parent. He may play the two, well, this is a demo, you know. We can discuss what is the correct design. Do we need the consent of both parents for someone to be a friend, or only one? Maybe just the mother. You know, maybe the mother is enough. You know, the father shouldn't count. Okay. So in this example, it's enough that one parent consents for the child to be a friend, and the child can have two parents.
Of three kids and the children.
Say it again.
You want to create a group of.
Is this working?
Yeah. We hear you.
So you want to create a group of three kids where the three parents know each other already and they consent to this. Is that what I understood?
I want nothing. I'm showing what could happen if these people want.
Okay.
So if these three people who have each has a child, if these three people want to become friends, they can. Once they become friends, if their children want to be friends and the parents agree, they can.
Okay.
And once they can, then Carol... The child is Carol, I forget. Carol. The child, Carol, if she wants to create a group with her two friends, she needs to ask nobody's permission. She can do it on her own. Because now she's already friend with Dave and Eve. The parents agreed. Now the children can create their own group without parental consent. Okay? That's the math here. I don't say the math is correct, that's the math. We can decide, we can discuss whether it's a good math, bad math, we want the two parents' consent, etc. Okay? Thank you. No, it's thanks for the question. I appreciate it. Okay, so, and in this example, there is one teacher and two parents and two children, and the children may have additional parents and the parents may have additional children, but they don't show them. Okay, again, this is a sentence by Claude, but it's not that good. Still, I'll read it. It's impressive, but it's not correct. So sometimes AI can produce impressive sentences which are not correct. So the same architecture that would let parents protect their children would let workers own their platform. Sounds very promising. It's not quite the same because it's much, much, much more complicated to have a co-op compared to have a social network. For a social network, you need nothing. You need people who want to socialize, that's all. You don't need... You don't need democracy. It's anarchy. You know, you want to be friends, fine. You don't want, no, that's it. You don't need anybody's permission. You don't want to decide. That's it. Okay. So, part of our vision is, as I said, to replace the sharing feudal economy with the true sharing economy, with the cooperatives, digital cooperatives, and as we know. There are almost no digital cooperatives today. I mean, there are cooperatives, but on the internet, if you're looking for a business that is internet-based, we cannot really find a business that is truly an internet cooperative. And the reason, okay, since we have some time, let me tell you that, and then I'll delve into this. Okay, so digital cooperatives, joint work with Francesco Caselli, who is here, and based on incentive compatible co-op framework to be published in the book titled One Worker, One Vote, Harvard University Press, almost being published. So there's a plug for the book. And the components of the digital cooperative are, first, it's a cooperative, so it's democratically controlled by the worker, which is the definition of a cooperative almost. No external owners, all surplus remains with the workforce, so if they earn money, it belongs to them, not to some third party. And the incentive compatibility comes to ensure that it's not a philanthropic activity. It's people who work in the cooperative, they actually work in earnest, because the cooperative is designed for them to want to work and to invest in order for them to be successful and the cooperative to be successful. Now, to build this, we need much, much more technology. And this is sort of, yeah, this is a tentative design of the technology that is needed. So there's a lot of technology. And let me see what I should say. I think I would like to look at number six, constitutional governance, because in some sense, this is the part. For the last 10 years, I would say that 60% or 80% of my research was devoted to this layer, to the constitutional governance, because what you want, if you want to replace autocratic and plutocratic regimes by a democratic regime, you need to give an answer. How does a digital community behave democratically, and how does it work in an egalitarian way? So much of our work, especially in the early years, was on equality in digital democracy, and many of the 40 papers are on that. Equality in proposing, in voting, in constitution formation, how does a constitutionally democratic entity operates and modifies the constitution in a democratic way, an egalitarian way, all fundamental questions that we worked pretty hard to give reasonable answers to. And the final piece, which actually came out a couple of months ago with Andy, is this constitutional consensus integrated with democratic governance. And the idea is, it's this puzzling thing that you need, democracy is not consensus. I mean, could be, say, majoritarian. You need typically want the majority or some super majority of the people to want to do something for this to happen. But you need consensus on the fact that the decision was reached according to the Constitution. So if people don't agree that indeed the majority wanted something, then the whole thing breaks. Okay, so this interplay between the fact that the democratic process is majoritarian, but the constitution on the validity of the democratic process needs consensus. I mean, consensus doesn't mean unanimity. Computer science has worked for 4 decades now to build consensus even when there's no unanimity. When there are faulty agents or malicious agents, there's a huge body of research, which Andy has been spending, I would say, 90% of his time on this, 99. 100% of his time on how to achieve consensus despite malicious entities. So computer science knows how to do this, but this is sort of the bedrock on top of which digital democracy must operate, and these are the two pieces that we finally were able to put together a couple of months ago in a paper that I'm very happy with. Okay, so that's, and as I said, cooperatives are the first line in the definition of a cooperative is that it's a democratic entity. So if you don't have a solution for a digital community to operate democratically, you cannot build a digital cooperative. Okay? So that's why this foundational work was really a precondition for anything we want to do with digital cooperatives. And as you see, maybe I can ask during the question time, I can talk about cryptocurrencies if there's interest, but social networks, social graph, they do not need this democratic consensus. It's a much higher level construct. So for people to talk to each other, anarchy is good enough. Okay. So the conceptual and mathematical foundations that we've been working on for the last 10 years are in place. And what we're doing now is trying to build it using AI, and I'll be happy to answer any question you may have.
Great. So now we have plenty of time for questions. You can come sit with me if you want, Udi. I think the idea is we sit on the stage here.
I see.
It's all right. Okay. There'll be people with microphones. If you hold up your hand, I'll point out some people. So let's go, first of all, to the gentleman with the glasses there. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. There's a microphone coming if you wait there. Then people. Thanks.
How are you going to get the app onto the device in restrictive environments?
Like Iran?
Yes, for example.
Okay. It's an excellent question.
Of course.
And and actually, when I spoke to another faculty member here at LSE about this grassroots thing, okay, he asked me, what about the grassroots phone? And we don't have a grassroots phone today. We have Android and iOS. These are the phones we have, and we will work with that. So the vision of grassroots platforms will be constrained or restricted by whatever constraints are imposed by the phone operating system, which are not that difficult. Specifically about Iran, actually, we had some discussions about that. I believe, first of all, there are examples of preliminary grassroots type systems that have been used by demonstrators in Iran and also in Hong Kong for people to form local social networks that don't use the internet at all, don't even if there's an internet blackout, that allow them to communicate with each other. And this worked using a protocol called Bluetooth LE, which actually is part of the, if I go back a couple of slides, you see there is a internet protocol and BLE. So there's Bluetooth allows people to communicate over about 100 meters distance. So if a group of people is dense enough during a demonstration or any kind of organized activity, then they can communicate even without the internet. So such applications, you know, it's nice to be able to download them from the App Store or from the Google Play, but you can install things as you wish. So the answer is that in such environments, grassroots systems can provide people with the ability to organize and communicate even when the regime objects.
Why not Wi-Fi hotspots?
Wi-Fi and hotspots are perfect, except in Iran, what they did when the demonstration started, they stopped, they blocked the internet.
No, but this is local. I mean, you can use
phone.
You can
yes.
go to
yes.
from my phone to your phone.
Of course. So
without Bluetooth. I mean,
yes. So any local communication, BLE, Wi-Fi, anything that works despite blockage of the internet would allow this to work. And by the way, just there was in the early days of Xerox PARC, if you haven't heard of Xerox PARC, Xerox PARC is when almost everything useful in computers has been invented. But Xerox was a copier company, so they thought, well, computers is like this thing which, you know, will interferes with our main business of copiers. So they didn't take advantage of that. But they had a system in which salespeople would, and when they meet, their computers would exchange data. So even before the internet, you know, so the network was just people meeting and communicating peer to peer that way. So the idea is pretty old. Yeah.
Okay, you have to take a question here.
Hi, you mentioned BLE. Are you familiar with the app Briar?
Which app?
Briar.
I think I heard the name.
So Briar is available on Android. And unfortunately, if you install it on your phone and you go to China and they do their scan, which they can do on tourists now, you'll get arrested because they'll think you're a spy.
Okay.
So basically, for everyone listening, the issue is that once you have connection over BLE with another phone, that's the kind of technology that spies are using. And you can be sitting in a hotel, in the lobby or wherever, and you're invisible to three-letter agencies. And they don't like that. So what you're talking about here is absolutely fantastic. I'm well behind it. There'll be a whole community of Linux people and privacy people all behind it. How are you going to get it past the three-letter agencies to get them to accept it?
Yeah, I don't know.
We need to
make
something different.
Okay, we have a question at the front here. Blue jacket, yeah.
Thank you. I'm just wondering to what extent you've thought about the kind of other side of the problem, in the sense that you're talking about a supply side solution, supplying the technology, and I understand that's the focus of your research, but just for this forum, to what extent you've thought about the demand side of the issue. I think thinking about, you know, the sort of death of the internet, if you will, a lot of that was people voluntarily moving from less controlled, less centralized systems to more centralized, more controlled systems. And so how you think about that challenge, if you do provide this infrastructure, how do you actually convince people to use it?
Okay. So first of all, I think the answer is that's why I'm here at LSE, for people to help me think about that. And with Francesco, we're thinking about that. The question is indeed the value that people will have, and I don't know, you know, I don't know how much value people put on their child's safety, you know. I don't know. If they put a lot of value, then maybe they'll move quickly to child-safe social networking. If they don't care, they don't. And specifically in the context of competing with cooperatives like Uber, there's already a way in the sense that drivers already have several apps that they work with. So they already know how to move between apps. So if there will be another app, which is a cooperative, which gives them all the benefits and they retain much higher percentage of what they earn, and the customers know that this cooperative is actually local, so that if they use the cooperative, then the money doesn't go overseas to some people on the other side of the Atlantic, but remains in the community, I think that this could help. And also there's a lot of, another aspect is the government and the desire to support local communities. For me, I think the main kind of, at the highest level, I think the main damage that global platforms are doing is that they're robbing local communities of capital, of human capital, of social capital, of economic capital, political capital. They're sort of moving capital away from communities to the global platform. And one way to view this grassroots architecture is basically trying to bring capital back to the local community. So that basically allowing people to conduct their digital lives the way they conduct their real lives, you know, within the community, among the community, by the community, etc. So I think local communities may want to do that. Maybe they're not powerful enough, but maybe governments who want to encourage local communities will actually do that. And kind of the pipe dream is related to regulation, you know. A decade ago, you know, all the EPA could do is, you know, 20 miles per gallon, 21, 28, 30, 31, that's it. But once an alternative technology emerged, people just regulate away petrol-based cars, and that's it, you know. You don't have to use them, you use this. So everybody knows the harm of global platforms, but it's very difficult to regulate them away, like, you know, with some countries started to ban social networks for kids, etc. It's very difficult to do that. Part of the reason is that there's no alternative. Once this is offered as an alternative, maybe regulators will actually give it, backwind, by regulating away the competition because it's harmful, and finally there is an alternative which is not harmful. So that's another venue, but again, I'm here to think and discuss about that.
Let's take a question at the front here.
Yeah. It's just this lady here in a dark jacket.
Hi. I was wondering if perhaps you've already thought about or imagined how this technology might be used to insulate against disinformation or troll networks. I think it's one of the most prominent problems of the internet at the moment, especially that a lot of this information involves real people with individual devices peddling the disinformation.
Can you help me? How could the technology be used against disinformation?
Yeah, actually this is, thanks for the question. Thanks for, you know, allowing me to answer. I think, let me start from the end. I think this is the only solution for deepfake. What we're offering is the only solution to deepfake, and I'll try to explain. Grassroots social networks are work between people, real people that establish friendships based on knowing each other. Now there's underlying technology of cryptography and public keys and encryption and signatures. All this is basically ensuring that provenance. So when you receive something from your friend, you know either your friend created this content or it was forwarded by his friend or her friend that created that content. Everything is signed, and there's verifiable provenance for every piece of information that is flowing. So there can be no deep fake in the sense that every piece of content is signed by its creator. Now, if the creator decided to fake, then it's not deep fake. It says, I am created fake, and here's my signature that on the fake that I've created, okay? So there's culpability and verifiability. So I think there's no other solution to deepfake than grassroots social networks that use interpersonal relationships as the basis of trust and have provenance, signatures and provenance for every piece of data that's being sent around. Thanks for the question.
Okay, the gentleman in the blue jacket there.
Thanks. This is really interesting.
Can you raise the volume of the? Not to you. I'm asking the whoever controls the volume.
It's like it's on.
No. I'm asking the controller at the back because I can't hear even when you speak. Okay. The problem is not you. You are perfect.
The problem is way
back there.
I'll try to speak up.
Okay.
How would your research program sort of square with the extreme concentration of computing power that we've seen in AI data centers across the world with the rise of generative AI, because it seems unlikely that we would be able to get the concentration of compute that we need to perform the computations for modern science on a decentralized smartphone-based structure?
Okay. You know? Excellent question, and I should hold my phone so I feel some confidence, you know, I have this thing. Okay, here's the phone. And the reason I want to hold it is because it's more powerful. As I said, it's thousands or hundreds of times more powerful than the workstations that we used to build the internet 30 years ago. But it's probably a million times more powerful than the computer that was built at the Weizmann Institute in 1954 called the Golem, which occupied the entire basement of a huge building, okay? So it was like a basketball court, you know, size. And every gate, every register was like this high, you know, it was switches, and so this was the size of register. You could see the registers are this big. So I have several answers. So that's just a perspective. That's not the answer, that's a perspective. The first answer is I don't know. Okay, but I have additional answers. One is that the way AI develops today has nothing to do with the interest of humanity, with the interest of science, with how things should be done to improve our understanding. It is driven solely by commercial interests and solely by desires to by belief that it's a winner-takes-all situation, and we've been there and done that, therefore we must win again, therefore we must put billions and billions and billions behind the key players. Nobody said that I should be like that. It's totally a commercial interest game that is driving AI in an extremely specific direction that has nothing to do with science. Okay? I can imagine a completely different research direction that looks at personalized AI, that creates tiny, efficient AI engines that run here and are taught by individuals to serve their interests. You know why nobody is developing this? Because there's no money. But it could be the right thing. So it's not inevitable, okay? And I want to compare it also to Bitcoin, okay? Bitcoin is a total, enormous environmental disaster. It's unbelievably inefficient. It does 7 transactions per second compared to, it's a million times less efficient than Visa. And it's being run and executed solely to serve greed, okay? And there's a way, computer science has already developed ways to do the same thing. Even if you don't like plutocracy, which I don't, you can still run it without wasting, destroying the planet. Ethereum has shown that you can run cryptocurrencies without destroying the planet. And why Bitcoin is doing the way it's doing? Because there's so much money already invested in the way it's doing, and so many people will lose money if this goes a different way, then it continue destroying the planet the way it does. So we should separate between, we should kind of untangle what is technology, what is science, what are commercial interests, and they're typically totally disaligned. So again, I'm an AI expert in the sense that my PhD thesis was in AI, unfortunately it was 40 some years too early. Not unfortunately. I was working in AI in the very early days, but today I'm not part of that community. I'm not at the forefront. I have many colleagues who work in this, and they know it, and they know about it much more than I do. But as a bystander and someone who've seen technologies and understand how they're driven, I can tell you that in my opinion, it is totally not the only way that it could be done. Okay. And just to complete the answer, the reason I raise sustainability is that grassroots platforms are fundamentally sustainable in the following sense. There's nothing there except phones talking to each other. That's it. And if you put some little AI here, you'll have AI.
Let's take the person in glasses at the back there, yeah.
Thanks so much. I wonder what you think of Mastodon.
Can someone do something about the volume of the... this? I'm hard of hearing, but...
Shall I talk louder? I wonder what you think of Mastodon, the decentralized social media.
Okay, there was one Mastodon, it's about Mastodon, it's called the Federated System, and there's a whole thing called Fediverse. So actually, I was not doing justice. I wanted to simplify things, so I showed only 2 columns, but actually there should be 4 columns. And in the scientific paper that talks about it, there are 4 columns, 4 types of architectures: centralized autocratic, decentralized plutocratic, and then federated, which is oligarchic, you may say. The federated architecture, or Fediverse, is an alternative architecture that was developed by a lot of people, including Tim Berners-Lee, who is the founder, developer of the World Wide Web, the web protocol. And the goal there is indeed to distribute control by having multiple servers that talk to each other so that you can connect to any server you want, and then people can talk to each other through multiple servers. It is definitely a step in the right direction, okay? But it is not grassroots, in the sense that there are still servers, there are people who control the servers, and you must connect to a server to talk to other people. So it's a two-class system. There are server operators and normal people. Okay, so it's better. It's better than centralized, better than plutocratic, but grassroots goes all the way. And there's actually this paper that talks about all 4 classes, give a mathematical characterization that explains why they're not the same. Okay.
Let's have the lady at the front here with the glasses, yeah.
I'm looking at your slide and listening to your talk. My question is about how you envision the transition to this grassroots system.
Okay.
Are these levels of a transition, or are these different systems on a grassroots system that we would need to function? And if that second is the case, how do we transition this direction? What is the mother who is worried about her child? What does she have to give up to go to the grassroots system?
Okay. Your question has multiple components, so I'll try to answer them separately. First of all, I've been around for quite some time as an active scientist, and unfortunately, almost everything I did was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 decades too early. Okay? So I really hope that this is not 5 decades too early. Okay? I really hope. Maybe AI will get it sooner. I'm serious, by the way, about the 5 decades. 2000, one of the slides I showed you was about biomolecular computers that I did in early 2000. They were purported as programmable drugs. You can actually build molecular computers that can function as programmable drugs. That was the idea, and we showed it in a test tube and got a lot of press for it. And then the student who led this work became a professor at ETH Basel in Switzerland, and 3-4 years ago we started a company to actually do drugs based on that. So if things go well, so we start, this is 2000, the first paper was 2002. If things go well, by 2050 there will be drugs that people can use based on that. So 50 years. Maybe 2040, 40 years. So I hope this is not, this will not take that long. And again, it's the same question. I don't know how to, quote unquote, penetrate the market and what is the right angle and all that. What I agreed with Francesco is go all the way to the top. And we're gonna try to do the research proposal or research program we're working on is try to do a cooperative Uber, you know, which has all the layers of technology up there. Whether we could deploy before social networks, maybe someone else will do it. The technology is open, you know. But the answer is that if and when this is a high-quality smartphone app that can run, downloaded and run by anybody, then the mother will have to create a critical mass of people who want to use it locally. That's all, you know, her friends, her class, her children, that's it. That's all. So I hope I answered the multifaceted question.
I think part of the question was to explain the diagram there. What are the different
elements? So I intended to flash it and then remove it, but it got stuck here. So let me try and explain. First of all, what is computer science? Okay, big question. At the end here, there's only physics. There's no computers, no computer science, nothing. It's just a bunch of electrons running around. So computer science does not exist in the real world. Okay, in the real world, there's only physics. So what is computer science? Computer science is about identifying and building layers and layers and layers of abstractions. Okay, mathematical abstractions, conceptual abstractions. It's all layers of abstractions. So a programming language is just an abstraction. An algorithm is an abstraction. An architecture is an abstraction. At the end, it all collapses down into physics, just electrons running around. That's all. It doesn't exist. So what we see here is just layers and layers of abstraction that are needed to build the top layer, which is the Uber co-op. Okay? So what are these layers? The bottom one, okay, smartphone, it's this thing. Okay. iOS Android, it's the software that runs on the smartphone. IPBLE is the networking protocol that we will use. Tomorrow we may use something else, better, whatever comes up. The fourth thing is the programming. So you could program it. You need to program the computer and the smartphone, and there are technologies for programming smartphones. You know, we use applications. Actually, writing a program that works both on iPhone and Android is still an art. You know, Apple is trying very hard to ensure that people write only for Apple, and Android is trying very hard to ensure that people write for Android. But there are technologies that can be used for both. One of them is a programming language called Dart and Flutter, actually by Google. So we're going to use that. And we're developing a language that will allow us to express grassroots programs on top of that. Now, the reason why we're doing this, there are two reasons. I'm not sure which is the right one. One of them is aesthetic, because I hate computers, because they're so ugly, and I hate programming, because programming languages are so ugly, and I spent much of my life trying to devise programming languages which are not ugly, and programming techniques which are not ugly. And when I saw students trying to program grassroots platforms using existing languages, I just couldn't touch it with a stick. So I decided to employ some techniques we developed a while ago to program grassroots network, grassroots platforms in a way that I can live with. That's one reason. The other reason, which is just as true, I believe in the power of abstractions. And I believe that AI can be much more productive if it programs with higher level, more abstract mathematical languages. So the languages we're working with are very mathematical and abstract, and they were not successful historically because the average programmer found them difficult. Okay, so basically existing programming languages are a compromise so that average programmers will find them easy to use. But they're not the most powerful, the most elegant, the most concise, the most mathematically expressive, because the average programmer find them difficult. But AI is not the average programmer. AI is the best programmer. It will become better and better and better. So my belief was that if I design a high-level, concise, mathematical programming language and use AI to program with it, it'll be much more productive. And this is, you know, I started working with AI half a year ago, but what they showed you, the demos were actually written by AI using this high-level language with essentially without my intervention almost at all. I just gave them the mathematical specification, they converted it to this other mathematical programming language to do that. So that's this green part. And then there are applications. So we need grassroots social networks for people to talk. We don't want people to find each other on the net using WhatsApp or some other, or Zuckerberg or Musk. We want to give the infrastructure that all the other layers, the Uber drivers or the cooperative Uber drivers or any democratic community that forms, to form a democratic community, people need to talk, to decide to form the community. So the grassroots social network is the foundation which allows people to become friends and to talk to each other within communities, across communities, etc. And on top of that, the democratic governance, which I mentioned, which is the heavy lifting kind of thing we did during the last decade. And on top of that, cooperatives, which we hope to build in the future. So I don't know. I'm not sure which question I answered some questions.
So any further questions? Oh, there's a gentleman over there with his hand up. Yep.
So at the bottom there are smartphones, and at some point on the top people enter, but there is no layer of identification, one person, many devices. This seems to be...
It's here. This is it, the grassroots social graph. Everything you talk about, everything you think about is here. It's people identified with public keys, all communication is signed and encrypted, what I said about provenance, etc. So all the everything is there, but it's grassroots. So there's no typical use of public key crypto system. Public keys is that there is an authority that gives someone a key. You know, I prove to the authority who I am. Whether it's typically it's company. The company comes with the registration documents to the authority and says, "Hi, I'm a new company, that's my name, please give me a key which will be associated with my company," and then the authority gives it. And the internet is structured like this, top-down. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about grassroots. In a grassroots social network, everybody invents their own public key, and when you and I meet, we just exchange public keys, and I'll trust you. You know why? Because we met, and we sat in an office, and you interviewed me, and you wrote down, and we corresponded. So I know you, I trust you, and that's how, you know, connections are made in the grassroots social network.
So if that's the way, will there be maybe an army of smartphones that are trying to get into different grassroots platforms?
Well, okay. The question of fake identities and how they're penetrated is maybe one of the biggest challenges for existing social networks and why they cannot be democratic. Even at some point, Zuckerberg said, you know, let's do some kind of democratic thing in Facebook. Do you know how many fake accounts, I think I told you in the interview, maybe, I'm not sure. Do you know how many fake accounts Facebook removes every quarter? Who knows? I guess. How many fake accounts Facebook removes? It's written in the public document, it's not a secret. How many fake accounts they remove every quarter? 1 million, 2 million, 6 million, 10 million. Anybody?
300 million.
Hmm?
300 million.
300 million. We have 300 million. First, second, 500 million. 500 million once, twice, third, a billion accounts every quarter. Facebook removes a billion fake accounts every quarter. Okay, that's the existing life. I offer you completely different new life, where people are talking only to people they know and trust. You cannot penetrate. How can you penetrate it? You need to get someone to trust you. But if you don't exist and you're not a real person, why would they talk to you at all? So a grassroots social network is built on real people having real connections that establish this and grow based on this mutual trust and mutual knowledge. And you know, if you tell me that this other person is your friend and it's real and that's her name is Dana or whatever, I'll trust you and I'll become friend with Dana because I know you and I trust you, and then I'll get to know Dana. But you will not introduce me to 500 fake accounts. I know you, you will not. I trust that you will not.
Okay, I think there was a question right at the back there. Yeah.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ ask social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thank you so much for inspiring talk. I have two questions. One of them is, I think this solution where people have to know each other in person in order to establish trusted relationship is a great solution for networks around friends or colleagues. But in the reality, before when social media were not taken over by politicians who destroy them, actually it does make sense to follow someone who is an expert in the field, because I like the computer science tweets, for example, on Twitter, right? So we don't know each other in person. We would have never met, perhaps, but it still makes a sense to have a loose network with someone, for example, of professional authority. So how would you solve this problem? And number two...
I have very short-term memory, a very very small short-term memory. I can answer one question at a time. What was the question? Mm-hmm.
How do you solve the problem that, okay, it's useful for people to be able to connect with people they don't know. Like, for example, yeah, you might want to follow a well-known scientist.
So, yeah, actually, we're building this grassroots social network as we speak. You know, I have students and collaborators that are working with this, and I showed you this child-safe social network and how to build small groups like WhatsApp-like groups. And the question is, how do you create network celebrities, right? You want network celebrities. You want to follow someone who's out there, you never met them in person, but you heard of them because they have nice songs or they speak about meditation or whatever, and you want to follow them. Fine. We will provide, through grassroots mechanisms, we will provide a way for you to choose to follow someone else. And if they choose to send you the information, then they will send it, but there's no third party to control that. It will be your choice to follow that person and their choice to disseminate their feed to you. Is this an answer, more or less? Now, as I said, it's not that I have this secret box full of answers and I'm pulling one. This is all early stage. We're kind of feeling our way in the dark, trying to find the right way to do things. And we have examples of working systems, and we have examples of why these systems don't work. So we certainly want to provide existing functionality, such as network celebrities. We don't want to eliminate network celebrities. They're so important for some people. So we will provide mechanisms, but the point is you don't need a third party. You don't need Zuckerberg. You don't need Musk. Elon Musk to support the underlying infrastructure for some people to follow another person. Okay, that's...
And my second question, if I can. I think you're stressing the need to not to have a server or some authority. And I think the way I think this is a great idea. The way I think we can also consider going as a society is to understand the access to the internet and data should be in a government ownership. It should not be owned by five Nazis in Silicon Valley. That's the problem. Who are using it for personal profit? So if we have governments, just like governments are owning, say, roads, and we can all drive cars. You don't need to have private roads and have someone who would be charging us to use it, although there are some systems in the world. So if say, European Union or whatever, some democratically elected authority runs the system for free, just like internet was for free when it was established, in CERN by the researchers, it would be free for us to use and pay from taxes. And then we can have multiple systems and the governments would run the servers. And the data then could be centralized and used by researchers for public good and or for good for investing into back into the society. So do you think you would not lose this opportunity if it's completely decentralized?
Okay, I didn't hear everything.
She thinks government should control all information.
Okay, so... I heard more than that. So let me try to answer. The interplay between government and local communities and people and businesses is very complex, and I don't have a clear answer, but I have some thoughts which I'll be happy to share. First of all, let me give the more conservative answers, then there are the radical answers. Let's start with the conservative answers. The conservative answer is that I think that governments who care about their people, especially in the context, forget the U.S. The U.S. is doomed, and I'll explain if we want to discuss it, I'll be happy to explain why it's doomed. Forget it. But all the robber barons are there, and if you look at democracies, the citizens are hijacked by robber barons who sit on the other side of the ocean and exploit them. And it is in the interest of governments, of democracies who are not on the other side, to protect their citizens. So the question is, how can they do it? And as I said, one answer is regulation. Regulate them away. Before you couldn't, because there's no alternative. If we offer a true working alternative, the government, the British government, the EU, could regulate away these robber barons from the other side of the Atlantic. So but it doesn't mean, to do that, it doesn't need to own the grassroots platforms. All it needs to do is regulate the other alternative away. It doesn't need to own the grassroots platforms. What grassroots platforms offer is for people to own their own data, nobody else, because there are no servers. People own their data, people control who receives the data, and everything is signed, so there's a question of copyright, how you can ensure that, basically everything I say could be copyrighted in some sense. So that's one aspect of it. But governments can go even further. And I didn't talk about grassroots cryptocurrencies because they are probably too much ahead of their time. But one thing that they allow, one thing, let's talk about community commerce. One way a government could, let's say you have these local platforms that allow local commerce, okay, through whatever means. And then there's the global platforms which exist and people, so the question is, should I buy in the local, from the local butcher through the local community commerce network, or should I buy from Amazon and get it landed, you know, by shipping from wherever it comes to my doorstep? A government can say, for example, local commerce is exempt from VAT. If they want to support the local community, they'll say local commerce within the community is exempt from VAT. So rather than thinking about it as a black market, they can think about it as a way to encourage local commerce and depress global platforms that exploit and extract capital from local communities to the other side of the ocean. So all this can happen without the government controlling our data. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, so the question at the end there, yeah.
Have you considered or modeled different assumptions on technological understanding within communities? And is there a level where the proportion gets to such a low level that this sort of system actually promotes worse outcomes than is already the case?
Well, I think if this is to be successful, or the way I think it should be successful, is to have, you know, applications that normal people use without thinking about technology. You don't need to think. I mean, when you use a good app, you don't think, you know, about all the multiple components that make it run. You just use it. And specifically, you know, the question is, where will this be most useful? I think one perspective, which, you know, I sometimes believe, depending on the day, some days I believe in it, is that the Global South is actually the most important receptacle for this kind of technology, because it will allow local commerce, local communities, essentially reviving, or as I said, allowing a community to conduct its lives in the digital realm the same way it conducts its lives in the physical realm, without paying taxes or rent to some third parties across the ocean. That's what it will allow. So all the functions that today you have on global platforms that cause you to pay rent or be exposed to advertisements or whatever, you could, using this platform in the Global South, without. Moreover, this mix of technology we're talking about, of IP and BLE, say there is a village, you know, in somewhere in Africa or wherever, where only a few people have internet access. The community could still use this and have internet access through some local connection, and some people have IP connection, and then the whole community can have internet connection using this hybrid technology. Moreover, again, I'm keep tempted to talk about grassroots cryptocurrencies, even though I was not successful in promoting this idea until now, but someday I will. Grassroots cryptocurrencies are based on mutual trust and mutual credit. And they basically allow local barter, digital barter. So if you look at communities in Africa, people literally go to their family members' wallets and take money out of it. It's legitimate social family behavior to go to someone else's wallet and take money from it, you know? So this idea of barter that moved and mutual trust and mutual credit that moved to the digital realm will just allow these people to continue what they're doing, but digitally, rather than the physical world is like that and the digital world is controlled by those people out there who determine different rules. I hope I answered your question. Not. You can answer it. Ask it again, you know.
Sorry, it's just whether, so you said about the sort of power being on the outside, but whether with the move to a stack like this, whether that power then just gets concentrated within just a few people within that community, and whether that could actually lead to worse outcomes than the people on the outside having that power.
And again, we have a different worldview, so I'm not sure we are communicating well, but unfortunately, I think today, smartphone penetration is more people have smartphones than they have food today. I mean, there are more people hungry in the world than people who have no phones. That's the reality. So I think And the grassroots platforms are egalitarian by design. People cannot concentrate power. I mean, they can concentrate power like in the real world if they are more productive, if they have more, if they work harder, they have more bananas to sell and they get more money. Okay, but there's no technology-wise way in which people can gain more control or more something if they're not. If you have more friends, then you're more centrally in the social network. If you work harder, you have more money. But that's it.
Okay, there's a question at the back there. Yeah.
I had a few minutes late, so maybe I missed it, but I want to ask about thresholds. The threshold to be included, the threshold to be excluded, and then over time we're building trust as well. So is there a process of upvotes, downvotes, and, well, that extends to social credit, which, you know, again, has its...
Okay.
The thresholds are being excluded.
I'm not sure I quite got it. Will there be some notion of like, social credit? Is that what you want?
That
was one part of the question.
How many people have to vote you in, or...
Okay. Excellent question. Depending on which layer you're talking about. At this level of the grassroots social network, you just have friends, you know? You just form friendships with whoever you want, and if you want to start a group, start it, and if you want to invite people, you're invited, etc. So this is totally anarchic. There's no... Nobody controls you, okay? You have friends, fine. You don't have friends, try to make friends. Okay, that's. However, once you go higher up, then it becomes a central question, and the central question is how democratic communities conduct their lives. Okay, and a key question in democratic communities is who gets citizenship, who is allowed to join, who is a member or in a cooperative. Do we want to add new members or not? And what is the mechanism for deciding, you know, whether to add new members or not? So this is a key fundamental question, and we've looked at it from multiple angles. One angle we looked at in the early days of this 10 years kind of decade of research was how, which is related to this question of sibils and fake identities. How can a democratic community grow without letting it be infiltrated by fake identities? Okay, so we have papers on that. That's it's a difficult question, and we have difficult answers. They involve graph conductance. Okay, it's a heavy graph theoretic concept that it has been used in a complicated way. So we have theoretical papers that show how a community can grow and still retain a bounded fraction of fake identities, even though it grows indefinitely. So there are theoretical answers, but I'm not sure I believe in them in the sense that I'm not sure how they're relevant pragmatically, because in real communities, you have real people that you look them in the eye, and you will not take an Uber driver. You know, you will not take a driver. You will audit them. You'll audition them. You'll talk to them. It's much more personable than just, you know, mathematics of how many people voted and blah 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 all this stuff. So we have a mathematical solution, but actually I think in some sense it's an overkill, because in real life you have just real people talking to real people and deciding to accept them or not based on whatever criteria it is. But it's not this computer science thing, you know. Like proof of work, proof of stake, proof of identity, all this. That is a lower level question which is not related to real communities which behave democratically. That's my current belief. I'm not sure if it's founded or not, but that's how I see it.
Okay, any more questions? No, then thanks very much, Judy. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.